Hey everyone, welcome back to the Contextual Insurgent Podcast. I am joined, as always, by Tech Bro Tito.
Nostruvio.
So, in the last episode, we were talking about the Twitter files and all the implications. And because, you know, we have a tendency to blather on because we think so highly of ourselves that it ran over a bit. We started talking about conspiracy. And not just the object level of conspiracy, but more the meta level of what conspiracy is. And you know, there's the right-wing fever dream of the round table where all these anti-Semitic tropes about everyone sitting around, you know, they always get dismissed as that. You know, there's the kind of the wacky sort of thoughts and kind of the very, the idea that, you know, you have to have, everyone's got to be on the same page, and there has to be a bullet-pointed plan for what everyone's going to accomplish, and everyone has to get together and have weekly meetings and PowerPoints about how the conspiracy is progressing. We don't really think that, and we thought we'd kind of expand a little more. We touched on it more in the, you know, the Twitter podcast, but we really want to have a separate one on that, and we decided to record another one. Anyway, jump all in here, Tech Bro, and just let me know what you're thinking. You look like you've been drinking enough to really kind of let loose with your Eastern European. What is that? The Shock Top. Is that a drink from your part of the world? Is that like a classic drink from the Balkans or something? What is that?
Look. Just because capitalist enjoyment of hops is infecting even stalwart communists, doesn't mean I don't hold to ideals.
Yeah, it doesn't look like potato vodka to me. What is that? So,
I will drive to get potato vodka, but you actually have police that will pull over and not allow to be bribed. It's not my fault the United States decides to actually enforce laws against drunk driving.
Yeah, it reminds me one time, a friend of mine, we were going somewhere and we let his Russian girlfriend drive. And this was probably like the early 20-teens. And because she's Russian, she was driving 95 miles an hour. And, you know, we got pulled over. And again, because she's Russian, it was a highway patrolman. And when he walks up to the window, she literally pulls $100 bills out of her thing and starts handing them to him. Like, no, no. That, he's like, what are you doing? And we're like, It was an embarrassing and yet entertaining clash of civilizations there, you might say, of cultures and expectations. And you know, now that we've kind of talked about that, you know, the unspoken expectations is a lot of what we really wanted to kind of get into. The unspoken assumption of how things work and how that implies towards a conspiracy. So why don't you just jump in there?
All right. Again, I think problem is, and this is sold by Hollywood as well, but Hollywood is there to sell product that people already want to buy. They have a very simple saying among con men, right? And this is, you can't con an honest man. And why is that, right? It's because, essentially, with a confidence artist, a con man, he's trying to get you involved and to agree to something that puts you in a compromised position so that when he steals your money, you don't have the ability to go elsewhere to get justice. So the idea essentially goes then, that is your greed motivating you to try to get something you know is too good to be true, you know can't exist really, and that by engaging in this essentially, you won't do it. And so basically, the right wants so badly to believe in a very simple, like, you know, a person laying things out like a Bond villain. A perfect example, you know, Ernst Stavro Blofeld comes forth and tells people exactly what the plan is, exactly what it is. You know, James Bond says, you know, famously,
"No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die."
Exactly, and then Dr. No, you know, "Oh, do you expect me to talk?" And he expects to be able to say that, "Hey, I won't talk." And he says, "No, I expect you to die." As opposed to can you imagine a liberal telling someone, "I expect you to die"? That's not the liberal thing to do. What the liberal would do is they would take their glass of Chardonnay, they would swirl it around glass, they would sniff, they would sip it, and they'd give a little insipid smile and walk away. Think about the liberals you know in life. Which sounds much more like a liberal? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. Or swirling Chardonnay, taking a sip, and then just a little self-satisfied smug smile and walking away. That is how it would work. And so the thing is quite simply, this is one of the problems of people on the right. They don't, I think this is a Ayn Rand expression, check your premises as it goes. They don't check their premises at each point. They think they're so smart because they've accomplished things in life and all this, and they have. And they are accomplished people. There are people that rebuild cars. There are people that make municipal water plants run. There are people that can, you know, hit targets out at 1,200 yards with a rifle and scope, or even further distances. They're capable of so many mechanical, tangible things in the world. And even if they do, they engage in sales, but they think that they actually understand other people completely. But they don't think about the fact that, again, shooting a target is not the same thing as convincing someone to turn the other key to launch a nuclear device, because you need the two-man teams, essentially, to unlock nukes. They don't think about that. They think that they're sales, but they don't think about the fact that their sales, if they're selling, say, grain threshing equipment, is only to farmers with similar backgrounds in farming, so they understood the scripts for farmers, and that selling to a farmer that has these kinds of needs is not the same thing as selling to an international businessman from Taiwan. And they don't understand what they don't know, and they're actually, again, too self-satisfied and too prideful to admit what they don't know. And so, quite simply, this is where, again, I will earn a reputation, and I am happy.
How you say that, though. It's funny. You're like, quite simply, 5 minutes of exposition later.
This is what you get for getting a man drunk and thinking yes, he's going to be clearer. Point is, the right cons itself into believing it understands everything because it understands tangible things, but it doesn't have humility to admit, maybe I don't know things. And that's a problem.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think it's, and I guess it's one of the weird things about, like, some of the stuff's intuitive to me, because maybe where I grew up, where it's like, you know, especially in the South, where there's a lot of the social codes and things that, you know, people understand things, they don't necessarily have to say them. But, you know, if you live somewhere else where, like, so much of the other country has been atomized, and, you know, there's no social, organic social culture or anything like that, or community, so things have to be more explicit. You know, I think I was, was it culture is the art of the unspoken assumption is a phrase that I once heard, and I thought it's incredibly apt, and it's very telling, and, like, that's sort of a lot of what conspiracy is in the world today. Like, everyone wants to say, hey, where has this, like, where's the plan to steal the election? Is there an email that says this is where we're going to hack the servers or something? Everyone wants to find that because they think that's how things work. And not that I even really think that's how even what happened or even how it would happen if it did happen. It's one of those things where the libs have an unspoken assumption. The libs share a culture, and this culture provides an unspoken assumption of what an unspoken assumption of what they need to do. It's, you know, and that's really one of the things is one of the things culture does is it solves the coordination problem. Like, how do you coordinate a large group of people to do things that are compatible and work together? Well, you know, there's one other place that has that problem, and it's the military. And it's interesting because the military does have this explicit chain of command, but it's more to it than that. The military has something called doctrine, which is basically the way a large group of people plan to fight. And that's sort of the building blocks for how they move large groups of people, because you can't literally tell every single person what to do. But they break stuff down in these blocks of people, and they're all trained, and they have a doctrine. So everyone, like, if you're like a general and you're looking down, you know, you kind of know what everyone's supposed to do, and they kind of know what everyone else is supposed to do, and it fits together. You don't have to micromanage every single person.
But let me stop you right there. I promise I'm going to let you finish.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is in military, specifically after World War II, U.S. military doctrine, right,
mm-hmm.
is that we're going to take people, the eponymous, the farmer from Iowa, we're going to put him with the inner city guy from Ann Arbor, or not Ann Arbor, from Detroit. We're going to put him with the you know, upper upper crust, you know, socialite from San Francisco, you know, and the Cuban immigrant from Miami. This is the idea of what the U.S. military would be. Everyone come from someplace completely different, put together, and they all are welded together to this band of brothers from completely different things, and it doesn't matter. And they're gunfighter, and they're training, and they're all this kind of stuff. They become a new family, and they become a multiracial, multi-ethnic, multinational, multi-background, multi-generational, multi-everything is completely array. And yet they come together to form this cohesive unit. This is historical anomaly, and it's very strange U.S. phenomenon that I don't think your listeners necessarily appreciate. Again, this is the right-wing chauvinism, the right-wing assumption, the right-wing chauvinism that leads to being an idiot. This is not how most militaries have operated throughout history. It's not how most militaries operate today. And it's not how most things operate. Okay, most things operate. Most things operate. You have stories, specifically, I believe, from World War I, where in England specifically, people would join up military together as a village. And again, not a town, a village. A smaller group of people. They would all join up together, and they were promised by recruiters they could serve together. They would serve together. Problem is, in industrial-style warfare of World War I, they would get wiped out. So you'd have an entire village that would get wiped out. The brothers would get wiped out. Everyone would get wiped out. And so this led to trying to change modern militaries, specifically in the West, and all this, to spreading them out, right? So you wouldn't have entire villages, entire families, or whatever, get wiped out with one artillery strike, with one failed mission, essentially, to essentially not put all your eggs in one basket, is expression. This is not historical norm, and it's important to understand historical norms, because spreading this kind of stuff out, this actually made the leadership, this made management, have to actually manage things more. So essentially what I'm trying to say is this. U.S. military engages in having all these different people from different backgrounds that don't speak same sort of cultural language, and people think this is how groups operate and interoperate. That's not historically true, and what that means essentially then is that on a military level, everything needs to be made explicit. So the thing is, quite simply, right wing people think from serving in military this is how efficient or good organizations operate. That's exactly opposite. In fact, because of this commitment, and it's an ideological commitment, for the reasons. There are reasons for it. But because of this commitment, it actually means that the management at higher levels, the officer levels, especially going further up, they actually have to do more coordination. They actually have to actually more explicitly say exactly what they're looking for, exactly what needs to be done. They have to lay things out a lot more, as opposed to making things more implicit, depending upon those kinds of things. And again, I can go back that this even sort of applies to Union versus Southern militaries and all this. The Union actually had fresh people off the boat from Europe going to fight and all this, whereas the Southerners, everyone knew each other and all this, and interoperated and all this. It's irrelevant. Point is this. Most organizations that are efficient, most small businesses that are efficient and all this. If you think of these efficient kinds of things, family businesses and all that, they operate because of this implicit code, not needing to say things, but people knowing what needs to be done and fulfilling it without things being explicit. That is actually the norm. And much of things that the right thinks of, for easy examples, is historical anomalies and not actually how things function. And they are actually divorced from the efficient management positions necessary to make those diverse elements working together work. And in fact, the norm is a far more cohesive, homogenous group making decisions without discussing them explicitly.
Yeah, no, I think it's, the word for indoctrination sort of includes the word doctrine, but that's part of the word root. I think that you raise a good point, because the military starts off with an atomized group of people and they have to make the training explicit. But then I was trying to think in terms of like doctrine is like everyone sort of once you indoctrinate people and everyone kind of understands what's happening, then you don't have to micro, like I for when I, of course it's micromanaged, but I'm just saying in terms of like the generals don't have to sit there and micromanage a private or something. Because everyone sort of knows how these big chunks of people, like everyone sort of knows the game plan. And at the higher level, they can sort of assume that the people below them sort of know what they're doing.
Stop right there.
Okay, go ahead.
Not every private knows what every private is doing. Privates will do very differently from privates. Every general will likely know what every other general is doing because there's a far more general kind of stuff. There's not so much different. A private may be, you know, doing scut work, maybe, you know, stripping paint from a Navy ship. A private may be, you know, sending, maybe, like, you know, fetching a letter between point A and point B. A private may be, you know, doing any, you know, tens of thousands, perhaps millions of different derivations of things in their daily duties. A general simply but because they're at that top of a efficiency management stack, their job composes of telling people what to do, hearing reports from underlings doing this, and it doesn't matter which military they work for, Russia, and it doesn't matter if they're Serbian, if they're Yugoslavian, it doesn't matter, you know, what their day looks broadly similar compared to a private where there's far more diversity. Go on.
Yeah, you know, I was just thinking about it. It's like, maybe that's not even really a good example, because maybe a better example is the Taliban, who's like, you know, their coordination problem was like, everyone knew, because, you know, again, it's like David Kilcullen writes about this stuff in Out of the Mountain, you know, the whole thing is like, it's not even really so much about have you to tell every single person what to do. It's like everyone knows what the accomplishment, everyone knows what the goal is, and everyone tries to accomplish that goal in their own ways. It's like, you know, there's a basic, simple set of rules that a large group of people follow, and they follow them independently, but everyone sort of, you don't have to, you know, a lot of these flat networks, these insurgency networks, they don't have to have a central leadership. Everyone knows what the objective is, and there's an array of different tactics that they use, which is a big thing Kilcullen was talking about. But you know what, probably a better example of that is the Taliban. It's like, you know, there was central Taliban leadership, but like the coordination role that everyone tried to fill was make the Americans fuck off and go back home. That's right. Really it.
Which is important because, quite simply, what Taliban wishes to do is they don't wish to create, to run, you know, Kabul University and to create gender studies things and to have people and to provide security against these things and to get into everyone's household to teach them about, you know, that your girl may be a boy, your boy may be a girl, to teach them these things that go against our traditions and all this kind of stuff. They're not trying to do that. What they wish to do is they wish to, you know, take these city centers and make Americans fuck off back home, and if people violate things in public, they get beaten. Next time they get, you know, they lose a hand. Next time they get executed and all this kind of stuff. And they wish to do these kinds of things brutally. But it's like, okay, if I was to instruct you that your job is to beat someone, if your job, you know, the first time they do something, mark their name down on a pass. You know, mark their name down. Next time they do it, you consult a little book of repeat offenders. You see they're doing the same thing second time. You cut their hand off and then you mark their name down. You know what you do the third time. I don't, you know, even if you're not that dumb, even if you're half drunk, even if whatever, you can accomplish that. And so if I'm taken out, you can do that. And, you know, it takes 5 minutes to explain. It takes less time. I've explained it right now. And they're only looking to accomplish this level of organization, so it's able to pass that down. Compared to, well, I wish to import a gender studies professor, and I wish to provide enough security between the Kabul airport and Kabul. I need to get the hotel room to... The level of what the U.S. military was looking to accomplish, it has so many different derivations, and again, it requires so many different components. It requires the soldiers to safeguard plane, to drive her to and from, to drive the gender studies professor to the airport, from the airport to the hotel, and then to accompany her because, of course, she refuses to order in. She wishes to go see Kabul because she's a liberated woman, as it goes. And then, you know, the private also needs to tell the shopkeeper that she wishes to get a headscarf that's masculine, even though there's no headscarves that are masculine. Like, there's so many different things that go into it. Very simply, what I'm trying to say is the structure that that one group builds looks completely different than the other one, and so trying to compare what a Taliban government looks compared to American government in Kabul, it's comparing apples to oranges. You know, except the idea is essentially this is a place where orange trees are resistant to a natural parasite and apple trees aren't, so you need to import pesticides. So you need to get fencing and you need to get people to check for little louses that will kill apple trees, and you need to have people that run inspection stations. You know, order the degree of magnitude of specialization and differentiation that create different effects.
Mm-hmm, true. So what about the libs? Let's talk about, because the whole thing is, we're talking about libs and the conspiracy. Because, we saw this in the Twitter files. This is what we're talking about, was like, there's not like a playbook. I mean, there's not like, there is lib central command where they're sitting around and they're passing out order to like the lib officers and, where... Here's our battle plan where we're going to like defeat MAGA and deplatform Trump. It's like, where are these people? Because if you look at, the libs are not a community, but here's the thing. This is what I'm looking at. It's very interesting to draw back to the military parallel, which is like, what is the basic training? If you're a lib, okay, a lib can come from anywhere in society. Okay. Where's the lib basic training at today? Where would you call lib basic training?
The basic training.
Universities?
Universities.
Everyone sort of gets the same.
Or TikTok. Or
well, I think TikTok could be, I think TikTok is more of a distributed kind of coordination thing. Where it's not like there's, it's more of a one-way communication.
Well, but that's exactly the point, right?
Mm-hmm.
The right-wing fever dream, great movie, great to understand you reactionary, simple, capitalist, right-wing, silly people, is Starship Troopers. Starship Troopers is right-wing wet fantasy, and it's created by a leftist, Paul Verhoeven. He's a wonderful filmmaker.
It's so funny. I think, did we mention that before? It's like, he didn't even finish the book.
Nope.
And then he said, like, it was funny because there's, like, the director and writer commentary, and the writer, the script writer is like, they were completely clueless, and it was very interesting because he didn't understand. Like, we're dunking on, like, right-wing, like, this book, this proto-fascist book, and we're dunking on it. And, like, he was explaining about the scene where they're dragging the big-ass, fucking brain bug out of the tunnel,
which was my point,
and
actually.
Doogie Howser is like, it's afraid, and then he said he was with his friend there from Texas or something. They were watching the film and his friend was like, you're goddamn right it is, and he was like talking about like he was completely mystified by why his friend would react that way. And it was very interesting because the disconnect was so funny. It's like, it's in the director and a screenwriter commentary during the film. It's pretty funny.
Right. And this is exactly the point. The point is, the right is looking for the brain bug. As we were talking about, well, where's the great indoctrination thing? Where's the simple thing we do? Where's the brain bug of the left? Where do we, instead of fighting millions upon millions of bugs, where is the brain bug? Where do we take out brain bug? What is the conspiracy with the brain bug? Oh, yes. Starship Troopers makes the bugs. A giant conspiracy. All run by the brain bug. And so if you take out the brain bug, you do it. And so this is a right-wing fantasy, because it's like, oh, there's a single point of failure. We take out the brain bug, and we can make all the other bugs just docile and quiescent, and it's all fine, and everything's solved. Lickety-split, very clean kind of thing. And that's not, again, it's a movie, but it's a revealing of what the right wants. The right wants there to be a brain bug. And the left, frankly, sort of understands the right's failure, even if they don't fully understand it. The fact they can make this kind of right-wing fever dream fantasy thing, even without fully understanding it, shows, I think, left understands right better. The right demands and it craves this kind of single thing. But it doesn't exist like that. As I said, you were looking for university. I say that exists, but it's much like Curtis Yarvin talks about a cathedral. Cathedral is his idea, essentially, to talk about what brain bug or what university is. What's cathedral? It's a spectrum. It's a network. It's a networked group of universities and companies and individuals and other things and all this that basically maintain leftist ideology and cultural power. There's no single point of failure.
And it's distributed.
It's distributed, right. And so the thing is, it's like, how do you find a distributed
thing? Do you have some commentary, Ellie?
And so it's like, but, you know, as I said, you have to understand it's Moore's moral code. And by the moral code, it becomes flexible, and it means there's no sort of single point of failure. There's no one brain bug to drag out. There's a brain bug that creates a strategic, you know, failure point, perhaps, but there are still many other brain bugs, and it won't take all the bugs.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's interesting is, you know, and this is one of the things that makes it so difficult to defeat is, like, you know, culture, you know, a system of culture-making institutions mostly solves the coordination problem because you're indoctrinating people. And, you know, indoctrination is when you implement doctrine, a doctrinal mindset into people, that they understand doctrine. And doctrine is the building block for an army. And one of the things, too, with that is because it's distributed, there's not a single point of failure. Like, you know, it's Trump was like, there's no single point of failure, and there's no focal point either. Like, in the sense of, you can't say the universities are evil. Like, it's one thing to say Donald Trump is a Nazi, Donald Trump is evil, and you can focus on this one person, kind of like the 2 minute hate from, like, you know, 1984. You know, the 2 minute hate for, like, Goldstein or whatever. You know, you have that one person in their face and you fucking hate them. You know, that's how people operate. And that's actually one of the things that goes back to, you know, history of, like, being able to target one person as a scapegoat. You know, the human scapegoat mechanism works by targeting one person. Usually, I mean, either one person or a personification of that group that makes it very, it's hard to just hate something that's distributed and has no real, there's no mental picture for it.
So World War II, you have Hirohito is metonym. That means essentially a representative point for Japanese people. By killing Japanese people, you're killing Hirohito. And by killing Hirohito, you kill Japanese people. They're seen as one and the same, and the two symbolizing. Same thing with the special leader of Germany at the time, etc., etc.
Yeah. No, excellent point. I mean, that's the thing is, like, it's when something's distributed, it's much harder to destroy. You cannot just, it's not like, you know, and this is, again, this is one of those things, it's a trope in films, and you see this all the time in any sort of film. There's always, like, you know, they had this in Star Wars. You have to put a torpedo down the thermal port to blow up the reactor, and it's like the one weak point, you know, the one concentrated centralized thing, and you blow that up and it's a huge defeat. And, like, they did that in Top Gun Maverick. They basically redid, like, the Star Wars film, which was, it was still a badass film. But it was like, hey, that's like Star Wars. They're just trying to they have to fly down the trench and then hit the thermal port. Like, it was literally just like the same thing. You know, so you see that, like, if you have something distributed, like, once you indoctrinate a group of people and they all understand there's a basic, simple set of rules for them to follow. Like, this is, you know, open source insurgency type of stuff. It's sort of, you know, John Robb talks about this, about the networked insurgency.
Well, and, right, this goes back to your work on Antifa, which is why you're better to talk about this kind of thing. People want to look for the great Antifa thunder, the great Antifa mastermind, the great Antifa whatever. It doesn't exist.
Well, I mean, not like what they're picturing.
Not like they're picturing, right.
There's
a network. Yeah. There are important nodes. There are important things that make it possible.
Yeah, Kyle Schidler and David Rubor were writing about that. One of the things they discussed was, you know, they call it the Antifa ecosystem.
Right.
Which is, it's a group of, like, networks and foundations. And again, it's like the other stuff. It's distributed. And they all sort of know what they want to accomplish, the same thing. And it's spread out. And that's how they, I don't know if the dog's here. So, here, I'll come over, Ellie. Come here. So, my puppy wants to join the podcast. She's over here. You can hear her whining in the background. So, but anyway, we're going to wrap this up shortly. So,
we need to bring it back, though, to talk, mm-hmm. actually discuss conspiracy, which we've done very little.
Mm-hmm.
A conspiracy of the left. You know, and I think actually we have the piece that we'll launch the piece with. Again, it goes back to a person I was talking to that said, okay, you know, you've shown me very extreme right podcasts. Not us. Very radical, hateful kind of podcast. He was looking for this kind of stuff. So he could understand the side. He said, okay, well, I want to see what the exact equivalent on the left is. And I had to explain to him that there is no exact equivalent on the left. So what I did was I linked him this podcast. And, you know, it's worth listening to the entire podcast. It's very erudite, very sort of, I'd call it NPR on a Red Bull. You know, it's very informed, and it's very interesting, actually. I really much enjoy the podcast. And yet, he said, you know, I said, listen to the last 10 minutes of it. And he said that, like, until, I think, was it the last, essentially, like, 30 seconds of real content, he said that, you know, he was going to tell me, well, if this is, like, far left, then call me far leftist, because, like, I agree with everything being said. And it's only the conclusion that, you know, when they came out and said that the quiet parts loud, as it were, that he said, wow, that is very radical. And that's the point. What a radical left sounds like doesn't really sound all that radical. You know, the right, you know, sounds radical because part of the thing is people want to hear this kind of emotion. They want to hear this kind of catharsis. They want to hear, you know, people shouting. And, you know, think of your Rush Limbaugh. Think of your Dan Savage. Not Dan Savage. Very different person. Yeah. Michael Savage.
Michael Savage, think yes. Dan Savage or Michael Savage are
very different.
Very different.
Very different areas of expertise. Think of your Michael Savage, or think of your Rush Limbaugh, or think of your you know, Glenn Beck. You know, Glenn Beck cries and does this. You know, Rush Limbaugh would you know, mock, but he'd also yell, and Michael Savage yells too. They are catharsis, and so part of the thing too then is the kind of rhetoric they engage in is very emotional catharsis. Whereas again, what the left listens to, you know, you can talk about the failure of left wing radio and stuff like that, and to some degree, I think Al Franken managed to do stuff. But ultimately, what the left does, it's right there before you. It's so anodyne. It's NPR. They like to discuss policy. They like to sound very boring. And yet, what happens is, in the last 10 seconds we discussed, essentially, they talk about abolishing capitalism and redistributing everything. And yet, everything before sounded very, they cited data, they cited models. Everything sounded eminently reasonable, eminently, and these are educated people, and it is educated. But everything sounds so reasonable that you don't even necessarily see the conclusion sneaking up on you. And so that what makes these people unique is that is that the last 10 seconds they reach the logical conclusion and say it out loud. Whereas all you need to do for NPR, and frankly they'd be great on NPR, you know, maybe a little too caffeinated for NPR audiences and themselves, is basically they say what they're saying, they say those kinds of things, but either they tone down the way in which they say it, or, you know, they could be a more you know, interesting NPR interview, but they just don't say the conclusion, and they just let the viewers conclude on their own, and that is what the left does.
No, that's a good point. You know, it's one of the things of, you know, not just like this abstract plan for how you're going to accomplish something, but more of building the culture and expectation amongst groups of people where everyone sort of knows what the plan is, and like you get to sort of ad hoc adapt it on the way. And, you know, I think that's an important thing where, you know, people keep looking for some grand conspiracy, and it's more of a distributed conspiracy. Right. They keep looking for a grand conspiracy in terms of a big round table. And, you know, yeah, there's like, of course, you know, the World Economic Forum exists, that's a real thing, Davos, all that sort of stuff. But it's less of more of a plan, but, you know, one of those things is those groups function not by getting together to plot this stuff, but more of like creating a high status, because status is another thing. You know, these groups function because they create, like, hey, all the high status people are for, you know, the New World Order and like getting rid of privately owned property, except you from the massive globocorps you rent it from. This is what all the cool people here at Davos are trying to push as the policy. And it's less about, you know, actual plotting than it is more about taste making. Like the people there are trying to get up there and create an ecosystem of, you know, institutions that will push for things, and then they create the expectation, kind of a cultural status symbol and status, a system of high status beliefs that these institutions will institute. So yes, my puppy is bugging me now, so we're going to wrap this up. What do you have any last thoughts there?
Essentially, conspiracy, 90, a good conspiracy, proper conspiracy, 90-95% of it is open, is public, is publicly sourced, so that they can say, "We didn't. It's not that we didn't warn you, it's that you were too stupid to understand it. You didn't listen to us, you didn't take us seriously, it's your fault, so everything can be blamed on you," and that they can actually coordinate most of it in the open without people, objecting to such things. And then further, when the revelation of the final hit comes, you can have, maybe not everyone, but you can have a substantial minority, even if it's 20-30%, that say, "Well, yeah, that's the logical conclusion of everything you said. If, we need to decarbonize the planet, fossil fuels are running out, if all these things are running out and all that, then we do need to redistribute property, we do need to get people to, if we can't convince people to lead less consumptive lives, we need to redistribute what we have, we need to take people from those kinds of things, because the only other alternatives are war." And, I won't say that as loud, but yeah, that's obvious. Maybe you dislike it, but, compared to thermonuclear global war, it's a logical conclusion.
And should you just say it? You said, "I won't say this out loud," then you said it out loud.
Yeah, well, this is what the beginning of podcast will say.
Yes, okay.
But yeah, right. The point is, good conspiracy doesn't need to say that, but when that part comes out or someone does say it, it's like, it's a celebration parallax. It's not happening. No, we're not saying to take away your property, and then when that part comes out, well, here's why it's a good thing, or here's why it's the only alternative.
Yeah, good point. Well, with that, thank you so much there, Tech Bro, and thanks for tuning in, everyone.
Mr. Ruvia.
Something to say? What? Now you don't want to make a noise? You were chirping all during the recording. Now you're quiet? I don't know. I wish I could mix you two where, you could dial back to be like her and she could be, a little more talkative. What do you think?
The fact you think dogs' wisdom is comparable to mine makes me question my life choices.
Oh. Oh, there she goes. She chirped something a minute ago. Can you chirp? Chirp?